Mixed results for Republicans in this election, from a president who won't concede to a runoff Senate race. We're hearing from our Republican listeners about what they want from their party right now.
I want the Republican Party to concede to the election results and stop dividing this country.
The Republicans are right in being cautious about declaring a for sure winner. I appreciate that, and I think that Democrats would appreciate doing the same if the roles were reversed.
His time clock has not been punched, regardless of any other outcomes.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 11th, we hear from you about the future of the Grand Ole Party and Trumpism. And then how U.S. relations with Mexico and Central America could change under a Biden administration. And finally, happy Veterans Day. We talk about Trump's relationship with the military.
He misreads a lot of where the loyalty for the military actually lies. It's not toward him as president. It's to defend and protect the Constitution.
But first, state election officials from both parties across the country have said there is no evidence of fraud in this election, and that's according to new reporting from the New York Times. And yet, days after the election was called for Joe Biden, President Trump is still refusing to concede. And that's signaling that the president's hold on the Republican Party and its supporters remains strong. So far, only a handful of prominent GOP members like Senators Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski have even acknowledged Joe Biden's victory. But whether the president's hold on the party will remain after he leaves the White House is less clear, and that's where we begin today. Joining me now is Nicholas Lemon, staff writer for The New Yorker. Nicholas, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Also with us is Brendan Buck, Republican strategist at Seven Letter and a former aide to Republican speakers of the House, John Boehner and Paul Ryan. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let's start with you, Brendan. Donald Trump is refusing to concede, and Republican leaders are standing by him for the most part. Why does Trump have such a grip on the Republican Party even today?
Because he continues to have a grip on Republican voters. We've long talked, I think, sort of theoretically about the stranglehold that the president has. But we actually right now have a really clear evidence of that, because there's a Georgia Senate race, and I think that example is really what cements this. He has taken hostage voters, Republican voters, and there is a Senate race, two of them down in Georgia, that will decide the outcome of who controls the Senate. And if the president were to turn on those two senators, were to say that you're not fighting hard enough for me, there are real consequences for those Republicans running down there, and the Senate could go to Democrats. So I think that that Republicans in Washington, and certainly the Republicans in Georgia, don't want to upset him, because they know that he's taken hostage the voters, and if he turns on them, the bottom could fall out.
Nicholas, when you hear what Brendan is saying, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are who support the president. There are other folks who are incredulous about what's happening. What are your thoughts on how President Trump has been able to really continue to capture not just the voters, but also Mitch McConnell and other top GOP officials?
Well, first of all, I agree 100% with Brendan's analysis that he just gave, so I won't repeat that. I think you should be a little careful about this if you're thinking medium to long term. Look at the words that Mitch McConnell and others are saying really carefully. What they're not saying is, we believe President Trump won this election and there is clear evidence of voter fraud. That's what the president has said. But outside of his very inner circle of super loyalists, you're instead hearing variations on the theme of, we're not ready to declare this over. We want this investigated. As Brendan said, that's a signal to Republican base voters and a way of forestalling a kind of revenge strategy by the president. But remember that, you know, you can argue at least that in last week's election, the party ran ahead of President Trump. And I suspect that a lot of these leaders know that this is all going to end with a President Biden, and that they feel some relief over that prospect, that they don't have to deal with somebody as volatile and as vengeful and as not in touch with reality as the president evidently is. So I think this issue will get resolved, But the larger question is really interesting, which is, what's President Trump going to do next year and the year after?
And we definitely want to talk about his role as it relates to the GOP longer term in just a minute. Brendan, I'm curious about why you mentioned the stranglehold that the president has on a lot of GOP voters. Why are folks so afraid of losing what's been called Trump's base? I mean, why is that such a fearful thing, and even incurring the president's wrath himself?
Because he is the party at this point. We are not in a situation where Republicans are defined by any particular policy or principles. Today, Republicans are defined by how much you support Donald Trump.
So has the GOP been taken over by Trumpism, Brendan?
Oh, absolutely. I don't dispute that at all. And it's not really the wing of the party, the populist wing that I'm from, but I would definitely concede that he has taken over. Look, you can't win elections if your base is discouraged. And I think what everybody is concerned about, you know, this cuts both ways. The president is out there telling everyone that elections are rigged and there's voting fraud. You can look at that's going to motivate Republicans and they're going to be fired up and they're going to want to make their voice heard. My concern long term for Republicans is that the president has such power over these voters that they're going to start to think that it's not worth coming out and voting. And I think that is something to look for in the long haul. But yeah, he has complete control, and you can't just walk away and basically distance yourself from him, because he'll come after you. And we've seen that many times. It's not so much that they're afraid of him. I think that's the important distinction. They're afraid of what will happen to their constituencies, their coalitions of voters that bring them back. The only election that most Republicans care about, and most members of Congress for that matter, is their primary. And if you have a bunch of Trump voters, and that is basically the bulk of the party right now, thinking that you're a sellout or you're not fighting or you're against Donald Trump, God forbid, that means that they're not going to vote for you. And that in a primary, that's all that matters. And you've got party leaders who are looking to be, you know, the standard bearer for the next election if Donald Trump doesn't run. And all of them know that they can't alienate Trump voters. There is a very, very small percentage of Republicans who are not firmly in the Trump camp these days. And it's just bad politics to alienate them.
Nicholas, when you hear that, I mean, let's talk about some of the ways the Trump administration has changed the party permanently, because I think during this administration, there have been conversations about, are the GOP, voters, Trump voters, are they Trumpists, are they not? And what Brendan is saying is essentially that that's what's taken over the party. So what ways has Trump changed the party?
Well, first of all, I'm not as sure as Brendan is of that assertion. I think things could look different in a year or in the run-up to the 2022 elections when President Trump has been out of office for a while and he doesn't have that incredible bully pulpit of the presidency that allows him to have the attention, including us in the media, 100% of the time. There have been people like this all over the world and throughout history, including in the U.S., and their stars do fade, and his may fade. But I think the impact on the party is pretty clear, at least for now. So I'll just tick off a number of things that were what he introduced in the 2016 election cycle that weren't on the whole where the party was, but now is where the party is, and that would be kind of anti-immigrant nativism, ethno-nationalism, skepticism of free trade, a much more uncritical attitude toward the size of government and government programs, the basic sort of libertarian Reaganite stance, also internationalism, all those things that were thought to be the soul of the Republican Party, they're not anymore. And I'd add to that list, you know, for 125 years, you could say, look, at base, the Republicans are the party of business. I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. Now the Republicans are the party that attacks Wall Street and Silicon Valley. And business, big business at least, on the whole, is obviously very eager for President Biden to take office. So that's a reversal of American political history.
Brendan, I'm curious about why it was President Trump who, I mean, this is something that's been building for quite some time, but President Trump really was able to galvanize his voters and his supporters and his base under all of the tenets that Nicholas just laid out. Why was it so simple to do that in a lot of ways? And what I mean by simple is that we've seen this real increase in the polarization, political polarization of Americans, particularly under this administration, in ways that I think many Americans have been shocked, including Republicans. So what was it? Was it a rebuke to the Obama administration? Was it the fact that the president was able to tap into aggrieved Americans who felt that this was the right message? I mean, how was he able to do that?
Yeah, I certainly think that he was able to tap into a feeling that a lot of people had that nobody cared about them. It's important to appreciate that the populist side of their party has always existed. There has always been anti-immigrant, anti-trade Republicans. Pat Buchanan is a great example of someone who tried to lead a movement previously. And as a party, we've always just sort of tried to tamp that down or appease it to the degree that we can, because I think most people believe that the policies are bad. But he was able to take a combination of A, his personality and the way he draws attention to himself, unending media attention, and tap into that part of the party that had been feeling very ignored for a long time, and brought all those together, and it was powerful. You know, it was a part of our party that had been basically bottled up, and when they finally had someone who wanted to speak for them, they came out in droves. And then it doesn't hurt that he has a lot of people in sort of conservative media who have jumped on board and are diehards for what he does. So he's got a lot going for him at this point. I don't think anything is forever in politics, and I don't want to give that impression. But I don't see what changes the dynamic right now, because the incentive structure is such that voters are still going to be listening to him, because we have a conservative media ecosystem that didn't exist in those previous instances. He will still be able to have a very loud voice. I think it's an open question how the media handles him. You know, the mainstream media, do they continue to follow everything that he does? But between his Twitter account and other, you know, news networks and websites, he's still going to have a really large voice. And he's already made clear that his kids are interested in being part of the party. So I don't think I personally wish that we'd be able to move on, but I don't think that the party is going to be able to do that, because he won't let it.
Nicholas, do you think he can do it?
That President Trump can do it, if you define that as keep everybody's
keep
attention?
Keep everyone in line, at least for now.
No. I mean, if we're asking a year out, will he be where he is now on that measure? I would predict no.
I want to just to sort of really look at what role you think Donald Trump could play post-presidency, you know, particularly if we think that his star will not be as bright given, you know, a year or after a year or two pass. Where do you think he would stand?
Well, I guess question number one would be, will he run for president in the 2024 cycle? And, you know, he doesn't have to say that now, but that would be pertinent. And, you know, one sees a lot of speculation. The president hasn't seen fit to call me and clue me in on his plan, so I don't know. But that's an interesting question. Plan B, would he anoint, say, Donald Trump Jr. as the carrier of the mantle, and he would run in 2024. The other thing that's been speculated a lot about is that he'll, you know, take over or create some giant media platform that would be sort of his base in the media. For example, and I'm just speculating here, you know, Rush Limbaugh is terminally ill and very close to the president. The president gave him the Medal of Freedom not too long ago. That would be a good platform for him. Or people have said he might start a TV network called Trump TV. What I don't think he'll do is follow the pattern of George W. Bush and take up painting and live a quiet life out of the limelight. So that's not going to happen. But remember, a lot of people want to be in the limelight, and only a small portion of them succeed in getting the attention that they want. So I don't think it's a given that he'll be able to keep at his current level of national obsession.
Brendan, I recall a couple of presidential elections ago after the GOP did not win under Barack Obama, and they decided they had to do a postmortem. They had to reevaluate what they were missing. And one of the big things that they thought they were missing were Republicans of color, voters of color, more outreach. Did this election show that the GOP will do just fine, you know, without that outreach?
I don't know that it shows that they will do just fine, but that is definitely what Republicans are internalizing. It's remarkable. You know, this is a rare feat to have a incumbent president voted out of office, and we're seeing that. And instead of sort of grappling with what happened, what you're seeing is Republicans feel like they had a great night. A lot of that is because down ballot House and Senate Republicans did better than expected. But there is no sense among Republicans that there needs to be a change of course. There was a little bit of improvement with Hispanic voters, I guess is notable. But this is not a party that has ever really grappled with itself or put itself on the couch to kind of think through what we stand for. We don't learn our lessons very well, but I don't even think there's an effort to learn any lessons from losing here. It's interesting, Democrats seem to be sort of more introspective at this point about what happened and why they didn't do better, where Republicans, even though they're losing the White House, feel very strongly that Trumpism is the way to go. And even if they don't think it's the way to go, they don't really have a choice because of what we talked about before with the president's control over voters.
I want to talk a little bit about that because, Nicholas, I'm wondering if any efforts to, you know, we have seen some Republicans, largely, I would say, you know, probably the most well-known among this this branch, if you will, are the Lincoln Project, who have, you know, sort of galvanized lots of money, lots of big names, including Michael Steele, who we've had here on the Takeaway recently, to talk about what they're doing to try and reform or gather some Republican supporters. But is that enough? I mean, are we witnessing really a splintering of the party where you might have some folks who are Lincoln Party or Lincoln Project, you know, acolytes and others who are just Trumpists pure through and through?
I mean, I think there's going to be, and there already is, I guess I disagree with what Brendan said somewhat. I think you're seeing and will continue to see a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. And by the way, also in the Democratic Party. We've had the same two major parties in this country for 160 years, which is weird. And the death of one or the other has often been predicted, and they haven't died. If you only have two parties in a country this huge, it means that each party has a coalition that is very diverse and sort of doesn't make sense. So I think the Republican ability in particular to make inroads among Latino voters with a non-Trump candidate is more meaningful. George W. Bush in his reelection campaign got over 40% of the Latino vote. So I think you'll see discussion of that in the party and attempts to sort of retain elements of Trumpism without some of the other elements of Trumpism, like the sort of constant barrage of untruth and hateful attacks on people and general unpresidential behavior.
And some of those votes were actually, you know, driven through misinformation about socialism to Cuban voters in South Florida, for example. So there were lots of concerns about their outreach efforts to more conservative Latino voters as well. But Brendan, how will this GOP work with a Biden-Harris administration? We've got about a minute left in the segment.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a few things that what you might call low-hanging fruit where they could get some things done, whether it's on COVID or transportation. Obviously, Joe Biden has demonstrated over his career that he's a deal maker, that he can bring people together and get things done. The problem is there isn't a whole lot of overlap in priorities, and that's where the rub is. Where Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell have worked together has typically been to sort of avert disaster when there was a government funding issue or a tax hike deadline. And they kind of had to come together by nature of a crisis. That's different than coming together proactively and trying to do something that, you know, they just want to do. And I just don't know that there's a lot of space where they're going to work together. So I don't expect a lot of big initiatives to take place in the next 4 years.
We'll be watching, of course. Brendan Buck is a Republican strategist at Seven Letter, and Nicholas Lemon is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And one of the many states where the presidential race came down to razor-thin margins was in North Carolina, which has only voted for a Democratic presidential candidate once since 1980, and that was Barack Obama in 2008. And while state election officials from both parties have said there have been no credible reports of election fraud of any kind across the country, Trump supporters have taken to the streets to protest the election results. Alice Wilder is a freelance journalist reporting on the far right, and she talked to Trump supporters in Raleigh, North Carolina over the weekend, and many of them repeated false claims about the election, signaling just how powerful President Trump's misleading rhetoric around the election has been.
So we're seeing screw-ups or problems are only in the swing states that we know who controls. So that just screams fraud right there.
We want Pennsylvania state legislator to just basically say, we don't care, Supreme Court, you're wrong. All mail-in ballots have to be in by 8 p.m.
The results were one thing on November 3rd, and now they're morphing into something completely different. Last time I checked, I didn't know the media could call elections.
And Alice told me just how pervasive election misinformation had become in the state.
What I heard was just a fundamental misunderstanding of how elections work in this country and how elections have worked under this pandemic. So basically, Donald Trump has been running a misinformation campaign sort of in tandem with his presidential campaign. It's been key to his strategy, trying to break down people's trust in vote by mail, saying that if election results aren't decided on election day, then there is evidence of fraud. So they are really following the president's lead here. It actually makes perfect sense to me that they would believe all of the things, repeat all the things that he has been saying for months now.
The president has also really been able to influence his supporters among the people that we consider to be his base. And it didn't just start a couple months ago. I mean, this feels like it started from the very beginning, where the president, in 2016 at least, in the lead up to his election as president, really focused on the quote-unquote white working class voters, aggrieved white Americans who in many ways had reason to be upset with their lot in this country. A couple of years ago, you know, we were looking at higher rates of unemployment, drug addiction, the breakdown of family units in many ways that were affecting largely white working class Americans. But the president seems to have taken advantage of those legitimate grievances and really used his messaging and a lot of his misinformation, at least, to influence them to support him and believe a lot of the conspiracies that he's bandied about as well. Is that something that you found?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And it's always worth reminding people that Donald Trump's political career began with a racist conspiracy theory, which was birtherism, saying that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. And even in an election that he won in 2016, he alleged that millions of votes were being cast illegally. So again, this is him sort of using white people's fear of a growing minority presence in the country, whether it's Black people, whether it's Latinos, Latinx people. He is playing on this fear and elevating it and using white identity politics to rile up his supporters.
And it seems to be increasingly effective. When you push back on some of the protesters that you met in North Carolina about the unproven allegations of voter fraud, what did they say?
You know, it was an interesting experience talking to them about it. I was speaking with one young man on the corner who was protesting, and this young man was alleging that mail-in ballots were being sent to everyone universally. And I have spent a lot of time researching and reporting on vote by mail. And so I told him, you know, I had to request a mail-in ballot in North Carolina. And this is something that varies widely state to state. And as soon as I corrected him on that, he was like, oh, well, you know, but it's universal in some places. And when I was speaking to that group of young men, one of them told me, I have a video that's evidence of voter fraud. And I said, well, show it to me. And then he pulled it up on his phone and he said, oh, it was just taken down by Twitter. So you see the speed at which these things are being uploaded and social media companies are trying to take them down because they're manipulated fake videos. And it's basically like a game of whack-a-mole.
Now, it's not just the protesters, Alice, because there are protesters, or should I say Trump supporters, who are protesting what they believe, because the president is saying that he believes that this election has been stolen from him. But now we're seeing more and more GOP, officials, including Mitch McConnell, saying that the president is within his rights to do this. So what is it that these protesters are looking for? I mean, at what point will they accept this election or President-elect Biden, or are they just not seemingly willing to do that until this process plays out even longer, as Mitch McConnell has stated it could?
I heard a couple of different things. I asked many of the protesters what they thought would happen next. One of them told me that he wants the Pennsylvania state legislator to openly defy a Supreme Court ruling around the election, which is a pretty interesting comment coming from a campaign that has run off of law and order. And then you have this supporter saying, simply defy the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, I've seen a lot of Trump supporters organizing online, asking supporters to email the Supreme Court and ask them to start investigating this election. Keep in mind, the Supreme Court is not an investigatory body. It is the judicial branch of our government. So it is just not even possible for them to do that. So people are asking for investigations. They are asking for state legislatures to defy the Supreme Court. I think when it comes down to it, from the people I spoke to, I don't think that they would believe the results unless they were looking over the shoulder of every ballot counter.
Is it just the president who is at fault in terms of promoting this idea that the election has been stolen, or is it also our media outlets to blame here, at least according to the protesters?
Right. I think that the president is responsible. I don't think that he is the only one doing it. I think he is the ultimate setter, and in the case of this president, breaker of norms. And so, you know, if he had conceded, there would certainly be groups of people who would say, you know, he shouldn't have done that. We believe that it was fake. But because he is not taking that route, people are following after him. And when I asked folks where they got their news, they said, you know, they don't watch network TV news. They don't listen to mainstream news outlets. They get their news from extremely far right, fringe, you know, complete disinformation websites. And so I actually think that the media has done a pretty good job of explaining vote by mail as well as we can. Of course, I'm biased because I'm a member of the media, but explaining vote by mail, telling people over and over again, we were not going to have the results on November 3rd. But, you know, if people decide that they are only going to listen to the news that echoes what they want to believe, then it's pretty hard to get around that.
What are Trump supporters going to do with this energy? The base seems to be energized still in this moment. And is there a sense of where they want to take that now? The anger against the media, the frustration with the Democratic Party, for example?
Yeah, I think that they will continue to have public demonstrations. The organizing around having people email the Supreme Court is one example. And in addition to sort of organizing amongst themselves on social media, it's important to remember that these activists are working in tandem with the Trump campaign. There are hotlines that have been set up for people to call in with examples of voter fraud. The Trump campaign is nowhere near conceding and is still pursuing these lawsuits. And I think their supporters in the street and on social media are going to continue to support them in those efforts.
Alice Wilder is a freelance reporter in North Carolina. Alice, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
While many U.S. allies across the world are celebrating Joe Biden's win as president-elect of the United States, others are staying quiet. Among them is Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and he told reporters on Saturday that he's waiting until the, quote, electoral process is finished. Under the Trump administration, Mexico and other Central American countries have largely capitulated to the U.S. government's requests, looking to stay in the U.S. government's good graces. And that's included policies around asylum and immigration enforcement that were meant to stem the flow of migrants towards the U.S. But as the United States begins its transition to a Biden-Harris administration, all of that could change. Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's back with us to talk to us about how all this is going to play out. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Tanzina.
So Manuel López Obrador over in Mexico has refused to recognize Biden's election. But what does that tell us in terms of the broader Mexico-U.S. relationship right now?
You know, it's a bizarre posture for him to take, particularly because it's hard to imagine an administration treating Mexico any worse than Trump has. And so I actually think in AMLO's case, what seems more likely than the fact that he's cowed by Trump and by what the outgoing Trump administration might do to Mexico, I actually think it's a bit of a personal psychological grievance he has. You know, he himself in 2006 in Mexico lost by a razor-thin margin, never conceded, alleged fraud, and resented the international community for rushing in to declare his opponent the winner. I really think a lot of that is the psychodrama we're seeing now in terms of his refusal to actually recognize the result and congratulate Joe Biden.
Notwithstanding, we do have a president-elect so far in this country, and that administration is the Biden-Harris administration, which is already beginning its own transition. Remind our listeners, the United States under the Trump administration created the Remain in Mexico policy, which forced asylum seekers to wait in Mexico before their asylum screenings here in the United States. How could that policy shift under a Biden-Harris administration?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, the incoming Biden administration and the president-elect himself have been explicit in saying that they want to end the Remain in Mexico policy. It's complicated to do in practice, though. At this point, basically, there have been 60,000 people who have been shunted to Mexico as part of this program. So the program, just to remind listeners, is basically that anyone seeking asylum essentially from Central America coming to the U.S., to the U.S. border, had to put in their asylum claim in the U.S. and then wait for an indefinite period in Mexico. There were over 60,000 people who went through that process. Fewer than 1% actually were granted asylum. There were huge attrition rates. People were brutalized while they were waiting in northern Mexico. And at this point, at least as of September, there were between 24 and 25,000 people who were still in limbo. What happened was in March, when the Trump administration closed the border in response to the COVID pandemic, everyone who was waiting for their asylum hearing got frozen out of the process and hearings were suspended indefinitely. And so now you have between 24 and 25,000 people who are stuck between these two countries. And it's not entirely clear what you could do with this population of people. And so while the Biden administration admirably has called out Trump for the Remain in Mexico policy, which is remains a huge indignity, it's not so straightforward what you begin to do with a population that's pretty large and that's going to need immediate help in having their asylum claims processed and vetted.
Now, Mexico, of course, is not the only country that signed an asylum agreement with the United States in many ways. Guatemala also had an agreement with the United States, well, the Trump administration, to manage the flow of migrant and asylum seekers there. Where does that stand?
So the three countries in the northern part of Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, all signed agreements that were called asylum cooperative agreements, but which we all know more commonly as safe third country agreements. The idea being that anytime someone crosses through those countries to reach the U.S. to seek asylum, the U.S., by the terms of these agreements, could simply send them back to these countries to have asylum seekers pursue asylum there. At this point, of the three countries that have signed those agreements, only one, Guatemala, has actually gone forward and begun to receive asylum seekers under the terms of that agreement. And that happened in Guatemala basically between December of 2019 and early March of 2020, at which point all bets were off because the U.S. shut down the southern border. And so at this point, there have been a few hundred people who had been returned to Guatemala under those agreements. But for the most part, I actually think those will be relatively easy to undo for an incoming Biden administration, both because the Biden administration has been very clear about not wanting to abide by those agreements, but also because they haven't been fully underway. And so I actually think as far as kind of unwinding things from the Trump administration goes, that'll be an easier thing to wind down just because it never fully gathered steam to the same degree, for example, that Remain in Mexico did.
And you mentioned El Salvador. The El Salvadorian president, Bukele, was elected during Trump's presidency. What will has the U.S. relationship been with El Salvador, and could that change under a Biden administration?
It'll be really interesting to see. I mean, Bukele had positioned himself quite savvily to get close to Trump, to seem to do right by the Trump administration. It obviously infuriated people in El Salvador and people in the region. And as a result, he was given a free pass on a lot of domestic maneuvers that are cause for major concern in El Salvador. I mean, he has steadily over the last few years really creeped into a much more openly authoritarian posture, attacking journalists, using the pandemic to further consolidate his power, flirting with an alliance with the military. Of course, under Trump, he doesn't get called out for any of these things. I do think an incoming Biden administration would be much more inclined to hold his feet to the fire.
Jonathan, I want to go back to Guatemala for a second, because under the Trump administration, we saw the United States support Guatemala in doing away with an anti-corruption body called the International Commission Against Impunity. What were the implications of that, and how do we expect a Biden administration will handle that?
Well, you know, I think for one thing, an important historical fact to understand about how the U.S. abandoned its support of that UN-backed anti-corruption body was that the outgoing president at the time, a person who himself, Jimmy Morales, and his family were under investigation for various forms of corruption, they basically struck the asylum cooperative deal, the Safe Third Country deal with the U.S., in part as a way to try to bolster their standing with the U.S. amidst all of that controversy over their ending that international anti-corruption body. I think, you know, the Biden administration's posture, if Biden's time as vice president is any indication, will, I think, be a much more standard American posture vis-a-vis Guatemala, which is to say, I think they would push for more systematic anti-corruption efforts to be undertaken there. Now there is a new president in Guatemala, a conservative, Alejandro Yamatei, who to date hasn't really expressed outright support for the CICIG, which is the name of that anti-corruption body. He has made sort of general gestures toward anti-corruption efforts, but has spoken more specifically about the need to have an anti-corruption body be run from inside the country, as opposed to having this kind of UN, more internationally based body, which I think isn't a great sign. And it will be interesting to see the extent to which a Biden administration really pushes the Guatemalans in this regard. I'm not sure exactly what will happen.
We also have to talk about Honduras, because the Trump administration supported President Juan Orlando Hernandez in 2017, who won the election in Honduras on what many say are questionable grounds at best. We've also seen corruption charges against President Orlando Hernandez, including from U.S. prosecutors. So where does this relationship stand, and how could that affect how could that be influenced by a Biden-Harris administration?
I mean, in many ways, the Juan Orlando Hernandez situation is the most interesting one in the region, I would say, precisely for all the reasons that you lay out. I mean, for one thing, his election in December of 2017 was marred by fraud and outright government intervention in the kind of waning hours of the vote count, which is eerily now similar to what we're seeing from the current administration. But as you say, Juan Orlando and his brother have also come under. I mean, his brother has been indicted in the Southern District of New York. DOJ has launched a series of investigations for drug trafficking, all of which point to Juan Orlando's involvement in all of these criminal operations. And so he was one of the first leaders in the region to congratulate Joe Biden, largely because he is a survivor, and this is how he's played the game from the very beginning. And he has always basically played to two he's basically kind of played off of different divisions in the American position. The U.S. is obsessed with stemming migration from Central America, and often pursues that end without any kind of broader understanding or interest in the context in the region. And Juan Orlando has kind of brilliantly played that to his advantage for years, both during the final years of the Obama administration and on into the Trump era. And so in some ways, what you see is that the Department of Homeland Security has partnered with Juan Orlando Hernandez on, you know, stemming flows of migrants leaving the country. And so for DHS, Juan Orlando has been an outright ally. But now simultaneously to all of that, at the State Department, at the Department of Justice, at the DEA, you see Juan Orlando and his family in the crosshairs of all kinds of criminal inquiries and investigations. So it's going to be interesting to see whether the kind of usual American fixation on stemming migration at all costs trumps this broader, more important, I would say, thinking about rule of law in the region. I have to say that, you know, Democrats on the whole have been pretty good about Juan Orlando Hernandez and the need to bring him to account. And so I think, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that a change in the administration, that a Biden-Harris administration really will be more aggressive in rooting out systemic corruption inside the upper reaches of the Honduran government.
What's most at stake for U.S.-Mexico/Central American relations right here? Is it under a new Biden-Harris administration?
You know, I think there is a real and legitimate fear that there is going to be a rush of asylum seekers coming to the border in the immediate aftermath of the inauguration, which, of course, makes sense. I mean, it stands to reason that after you've had a president who's spoken basically nonstop about ending asylum for the last 4 years and has largely done that, that there would be a kind of an immediate push for people to make their trips to the U.S. I mean, they're no less desperate than before. And in fact, arguably, they're more desperate than they've ever been. I mean, you have COVID ravaging the region. It's obviously been brutal from a public health standpoint, from an economic standpoint. You've recently had a hurricane tear through parts of Guatemala and Honduras, displacing thousands, if not more. And so I think there's going to be an acute humanitarian crisis at the border. And I think the Biden-Harris administration is already making plans to deal with what that looks like. And I think it's going to be extremely complicated. I think what always happens is there's a need for more thoroughgoing, farther reaching, deeper thinking policy in the region to try to improve conditions on the ground in some of these countries. That always takes a backseat to the emergency at the border. And I do know that the Biden-Harris administration is concerned that a border crisis would eclipse the broader needs in the region, but also would turn into an acute political crisis for the administration. And so they're very much, I think, alive to what this issue is going to look like. You know, one other thing to keep your eye on, I think, is that what the Trump administration has done ever since COVID broke out was they spuriously claimed the need to close the border in the name of public health. And it's since come out that the CDC was pressured into giving authorization for that order, that this was a politicized decision to close the border, that it was basically the longstanding fantasy of the Trump White House from the very beginning of Trump's days in office to close the border. But the fact is, now the border is closed. And the current administration has cited an authority that allows it to do so in the name of public health. The Biden-Harris administration, I'm sure, wants to lift that border closure. And yet, lifting that border closure is going to be extremely complicated because you have the population of people in northern Mexico who are stuck there as a result of MPP, of Remain in Mexico. You're going to have continued flows of people coming to the U.S. because that's always what happens when there's a change in administration and because of people's continued desperation in the region. And you're not going to have all of the resources in place to deal with all of it at once. And so one thing that I think people should prepare to see is for a Biden-Harris administration to be a little slower than we might want or expect them to be in lifting some of these Trump-era policies at the border. So, for example, you know, closing the border in the name of public health, that might not immediately be lifted when Biden takes office. I really think that they're trying to kind of make various policy calculations. And quite honestly, those calculations aren't entirely clear to me. I think it's a genuinely complicated situation.
And we're going to have to see whether or not that plays out. Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Jonathan, thanks for being back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's Veterans Day, so happy Veterans Day to those of you who have served and are serving. In just 2 months, the armed forces will have a new commander-in-chief in President-elect Joe Biden. And while Joe Biden is no stranger to veterans affairs following his 8 years as vice president and his late son's military service, he will be inheriting a military infrastructure that, on the one hand, has been bolstered financially by President Trump, and on the other, is also one whose top brass the president has been at odds with. And just this past Monday, for example, the president fired his third Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, and appointed Chris Miller, former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, as acting defense secretary. So joining me on this Veterans Day is Tom Vandenbroek, Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the news. President Trump fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper. This is the fourth firing. What was behind this firing?
Well, it goes back largely to this summer when President Trump was pushing to have the Insurrection Act invoked in order to quell protests following George Floyd's death. And the military pushed back very hard on that, including Esper. They didn't want to have active duty troops, you know, policing U.S. streets. So Trump was angry about it, and he never really forgot it. And at that point, it seemed to be pretty close to the last straw for Esper.
And the president is known for making sort of rash and public decisions about his military officials in general, isn't he?
He has. Well, he fired three more yesterday at the top of the Pentagon. And the number three official, who's the undersecretary for policy, was resigned abruptly and was replaced by a Trump loyalist and two other top officials as well. So we've seen firings by tweet. We've seen policy made by tweet. Exceptionally unconventional, to say the least.
Unconventional is one way to put it. I mean, I recall when the president was running his campaign, one of the first things that stood out for many people was how much contempt he had for then competitor John McCain, who had served himself in the military and had been a prisoner of war. The president has had a difficult relationship with military personnel and particularly with veterans. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think he misreads a lot of where the loyalty for the military actually lies. It's not toward him as president. It's to defend and protect the Constitution. And he's never quite seemed to grasp that issue, that he is not personally, this is not his personal force. And, you know, whenever there's pushback on issues, he seems to take it personally rather than as a policy issue. And that you've seen again and again, he's gone through four secretaries of defense, five if you include one who had to, you know, be a placeholder. So, you know, once there's pushback, that seems to rupture the relationship.
There's some early polling that shows that President Trump may have lost popularity among troops. Some folks are saying that they were considering voting for Joe Biden instead of President Trump. Why do we think Trump's approval rating with active duty members has slipped, Tom?
I think this is part and parcel to that. We just spoke about, Tanzina, that there's this pledge that troops give to protect the Constitution. When they see some of these norms be trampled, you know, he's lost some of their loyalty and respect. The Military Times did some polling earlier this year, and it showed a significant slippage in his popularity versus Biden's. Now, there's still probably a plurality who, at least according to this Military Times poll, support him. But that popularity has slipped dramatically.
Let's talk a little bit about what the president has done or not done for veterans. Has the president helped improve veterans' health care, for example, which we know is a huge, very important issue for veterans who have come back, many of them who have been sent out on multiple tours of duty to come back and deal with the lingering health effects, both mental and physical, of these deployments?
Well, there have been some improvements, but the main issue with veterans has been his false claim that the CHOICE Act, which has been very popular for veterans in seeking care was his idea, and when in fact it was born in the Obama administration. A few years later into his administration, it was expanded and enhanced, but it's not his baby as he continually claims.
We've been talking a lot during this election about mail-in ballots and absentee ballots, and some of the folks who have been part of that group are military members who are serving overseas. What do we know about those votes?
They typically come in, well, obviously they come in by mail if you're overseas, and this has been done, you know, for decades, you know, dating back to the Civil War, there were troops voting by mail. And oftentimes they don't, you know, arrive until after Election Day, but they have been, you know, postmarked, and they are legitimate votes that need to be counted. There's been some reporting that shows that in Nevada, where the race is close, some veterans would not have their vote counted if the president were to have his say, because those votes are, you know, the ballots themselves arrived after November 3rd. And he's trying to cut off the, you know, that date at November 3rd. So they may be disproportionately affected by his attempts to, you know, curtail counting of ballots.
Do we have any sense of what is happening in the Pentagon right now as these firings have been taking place over the past couple of days, and whether or not that is putting us in a position where not only our active duty troops are probably looking at this saying, what if something happens in the next couple of weeks before a peaceful transition of power? I mean, is there concern that this is also destabilizing to our troops and to our military top brass?
Well, there's real concern about that. Now, last night, when after Trump had fired these three officials and replaced them with loyalists, we heard from the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee saying this is all Americans should be concerned about this. I mean, there's the last thing that you need in a transition to a new president is more instability. So there is a great deal of concern about that right now.
Tom, there have been some folks who have said that the president, and I want to use this word very carefully here, or what they're observing is a slow-moving attempt at a coup. Is that something that you're hearing from your sources, military sources, that they are concerned about that, or do they consider this to be more bluster before the president actually leaves office?
The folks I talked to would not. I've not heard the term coup used. I talked to a former senior official yesterday about this, and his thought was, you know, Trump can put all these new folks in and he can try to do things, but there is, you know, an institutional Pentagon, there's a uniform military that, you know, again, we go back to this, it's allegiances to the Constitution, and it's very unlikely that someone like Mark Milley, for instance, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is going to execute an unlawful order. So I think this is where the institutional part of the Pentagon probably puts the brakes on something that could go, you know, seriously awry. No, I mean, that has to be the hope at this point, right? I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in the next 70 days.
Tom Vandenbroek is a Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. Tom, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Tanzania. Appreciate it.
And if you're a veteran or currently serving in the armed forces, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. And tell us how the Trump presidency has affected you. Again, that number is 877-869-8253. And that's it for us on this Veterans Day. If you have served or are serving, we thank you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.